Good morning and welcome to WJBM Studio in Jerseyville. This morning I am fortunate to have Alan Lake and Tammy Lake with me today. And Tammy's not going to do much talking, but she's the backup. You know, if Alan can't remember something, she's going to bring it in and straighten him out on it. So, right, Tammy? Tracy. I got you. Oh, Tracy. What did I say?
Tammy.
Well, it started with the T. That's not bad for me.
First
last, right. That's not bad. Sorry about that, Tracy.
That's right.
All right. And so, Alan, so you grew up in Edwardsville.
Yep.
You went to SIUE and Edwardsville High School.
That's correct.
You now live both in Chicago and you have a place in Grafton.
That is correct.
Well, welcome to the studio. Thank you so much for coming this morning. Basically, you know, this is kind of our veterans show, you know, and thanks so much for coming. Alan and Tracy drove all the way from Chicago this morning to be here with us and do this show. So, big round of applause for them.
Thank you.
So, tell me, you've got an exciting career. You got a lot of stories. Yeah. Where did it all begin?
Well, my dad was in the Air Force, and my dad's originally from Troy, Illinois. By the way, Tracy's right next door in Highland, Illinois, where she grew up. And when my dad retired from the Air Force, he ended up in a little town called Glen Carbon.
Okay.
So that's part of Edwardsville High School area there. And I didn't know what I was going to be when I grew up, except for I wanted to be a pilot. And in the Air Force as a pilot. So I did everything I could to start my military learning early, Civil Air Patrol as a kid.
Okay.
To get some flying time. And then...
so how old were you when you first flew in a plane?
Well, first flew in a plane. I think I was 12. Yeah.
When and how about when you flown a plane?
So when I flew I think I soloed when I was 19 or 20.
Okay. Yeah. But you probably were behind the wheel.
A lot of times, yeah. When you're going through the training, you're always, you know, sitting with the instructor pilot and stuff like that. But
yeah.
I just couldn't wait to do it, and I was doing everything I could to position myself to be an officer in the Air Force. So when I went to SIUE, they had an ROTC program. So I graduated from Edwardsville High School, went to SIU Edwardsville, and it was large back then. I mean, we went through these phases where, you know, militaries was not highly sought after.
What year was that?
I started in 82, going to SIU in 82. And by the time I graduated in 86, the popularity of being in the military was back up again. And we had 250 cadets at SIU, so it was great. And I had my pilot slot and was ready to go. So got commissioned. And they sent us to Columbus, Ohio. So I said, Columbus, Ohio, Columbus, Mississippi. I'm going to do the same thing here.
Well, that's why you're here.
But we lived in Ohio one time. Trust me.
Trust. Did get there eventually, not Columbus.
Before I get to all the story, how many places have we lived?
We had 17 major moves.
17?
In 25 years.
Woo! Sounds like one every... Less than two years.
Yes.
Too often.
Yeah, too often. Sorry about that. Columbus Air Force Base, Columbus, Mississippi. And, you know, that's kind of where things kind of changed for me. Because when I got into the jet, going a lot faster, we were doing spin recoveries. And so they take us up to about 17,000 feet, and we nose it over. And then we intentionally make the plane flip and flop.
Yeah.
And we have to do 57 things to recover it. Before we get too low,
wait a minute. Unsafe. What do you mean, 57 things?
57 steps to recover the aircraft from a flat-out stall spin.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And it turns out, years later, they did some research, if you just let go of the stick, it fixes itself.
Only one thing, let loose.
So, obviously...
Jesus, take the wheel.
That's right.
Exactly.
So, just watch the altimeter, make sure you know where you are, you know, because it takes some time to pull out of it and stuff like that. And that's when I started having a little bit of problem medically with flying the jet, because the fluids in my ear wouldn't center fast enough.
Oh.
So, I was getting the leans.
So, how fast were you going? How fast have you flown in a jet?
I've gone speed of sound before in a T-38.
What? How fast is that?
That's about it's close to about 750 miles an hour, something like that. I don't know. It depends on your altitude when you get to Mach, right? Woo. As far as, you know, how fast you're going to be going. So, yeah.
Okay, I just remember when I was a kid, okay, and that's a long, long time ago, that you'd see these planes go by and then all of a sudden you hear pop.
Yes, at the very
going,
end.
Going yeah. the faster than the speed of sound.
Yes.
Now, but I haven't heard that for years.
Yeah. You'll see those at air shows, and even they can even make that pop noise without going the speed of sound. The problem with breaking the sound barrier is it does create a big wave of noise, and in some instances, it can shatter glass, and so you have to be at a certain altitude. And even when you're at a higher altitude, the big boom, you know, people trying to figure out if there's been an explosion in town or something like that. So they usually try to do that in places where it's, you know, very not very well populated and stuff like that, and at the right altitude. So.
Quick question. Air pilots,
mm-hmm.
What percentage would you say are kind of like hotshots?
You know, I would say very, very few are hotshots. Yeah, in the military, because we like some that are edgy, but at the same time, we want people that understand, follow the rules, and can respect the process of doing something as a group, because you have to fly in formation, and you never really solo unless you're by yourself. Something
so
happens.
So that's kind of more of a movie thing.
It is kind of a movie thing. I mean, we have our folks that are on the edge, but you know, like, I think our best pilots are the ones that can do things in teams and also can excel on their own when things happen. So we have a lot of fighter pilots that can really do that well. Obviously, our aerial demonstration team is the Thunderbirds. They go out there, and every one of them, I mean, to be in the Thunderbirds, you not only have to be a good pilot, you also have to be a good team player, okay? You also have to be a good spokesman, and you also have to respect, you know, how we deal with people and interact with people, and you have to be a poster child. You know, for the Air Force.
Sure.
And it doesn't stop when you go home at night. It's everybody's always watching you. So it's respected that people get into that career field and into the fighters, if you will. And then later on, they end up competing for and getting into the Thunderbirds.
Okay, I don't want to break your concentration. Okay. So continue on. Sorry
about
that.
So because of my ear problem and whatnot, and how long it took me to finally stop having the leans and whatnot, kind of got into my head that it's probably not going to be something I'm going to like, because it would make you sick and stuff like that. But I love flying, and I can fly, you know, multiple types of aircraft, you know, with a pilot with me and whatnot. But the point being, instructor pilot, but the point being is it wasn't fun. And so I had to figure out what I was going to do. And so the Air Force let me become an air traffic controller.
What year was this?
This was in 87.
Okay.
And so it was very, very fast that we moved from Columbus, Mississippi to Biloxi, Mississippi to Keesler Air Force Base to become an air traffic controller. And so very interesting career field. I loved the heck out of it. I did. I mean, if they could put me in the control tower or the radar approach control all day long working traffic, I'd love doing something like that. But because I'm the boss, I've also got to sit behind the desk and manage the paperwork and everything else. So I only got my pro time, is what we call professional time, you know, about, I don't know, 8-10 hours a month, you know, getting to do that stuff. But I just loved it. But I got a chance to be the chief of air traffic control in Zaragoza, Spain, and then again in Altus, Oklahoma. After those two assignments, why, they sent me to Skye Air Force Base. What a great deal. I get to be back home again.
Yes.
So,
hey, what happened in Spain, though? Something happened in Spain.
Well, there's a couple things that happened in Spain. Oh, yeah. Well, for the sake of Tracy, we have two great kids. Our first two were born there.
Three great kids.
We have three great kids. Two are born kids. Three great kids. I was going to get to that great kid coming later on. Yeah, but you're right. The story may not go that far.
That's right.
So, and so, you know, it's funny what you find out, what happens to you in the military. You know, you wake up one morning and you don't know a couple different things are going to happen in your assignment that day, of any particular day in that assignment. So in one particular case, we were the transatlantic landing site for NASA STS 26 and 27. That's NASA has an agreement with the Spanish version of the FAA to clear airspace so that if something happens to the shuttle and it reaches managing cutoff MECO, then it can glide on down to Spain and land. We have a 12,000 foot runway right over there. So I'm watching everything happen, and so we're, you know, we're kind of checking the weather. Somebody's flying around. Colonel Casper is an astronaut. He's flying around in a C-12 checking the weather out and stuff like that. And, you know, everything's okay, fine and dandy. They worry about a scud layer because the pilots can't see the runway. There's a scud layer and whatnot. Even though they have telemetry that tells them where they are, pilots really do want to see where they're going as right. much as possible. So
you're in the control tower.
I'm in the control tower. I'm standing there, and then here comes Colonel Casper if he lands. And the countdown has stopped at 57. And I'm like, interesting. And Colonel Casper comes to me. We stopped the countdown because they didn't clear the airspace, and that's the center. So that's an agency, like the, like an FAA center. All this airspace has not been cleared so that the shuttle can come in if it needs to. And it's an agreement between NASA and the Spanish FAA, and nobody at NASA could reach or talk to the folks in the Spanish FAA Barcelona Center. And he looks at me and says, can you do anything? I'm like, well, this is your arrangement. I'll see what I can do, but I don't usually talk to Barcelona Center. So I pick up the phone and I talk to a supervisor and I said, I need to talk to your crew chief for the day. And I told them what was going on, that the countdown has stopped. And it, and what had happened basically was their system did not notify Barcelona Center that they needed to clear the airspace. And in the end, they were very upset that they had to do that because they had a lot of people, you know, they had counting on fuel availability and whatnot, and they didn't realize there was going to be a launch, so I had to reroute a lot of people. And they opened it back up again, and they resumed the countdown.
Saved the day.
It seems like minor work, but I had to speak to people in Spanish.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
And I had to convince people that it was in the best interest of everyone if we try to work together just one time.
Just get out of here. Clear it out.
We'll get out of your hair as soon as possible. But that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of like that. You know, we had a lot of different little things happen. So, I mean, they assigned me to Scott Air Force Base, and I get to be there, and I'm working on something called protocol. So I'm doing a special duty assignment, and I get to meet, you know, the dignitaries from around the world and whatnot. It was awesome. And then, of course, after that, about a year and a half later, I got sent to the Pentagon to work for the Secretary of the Air Force.
Nice.
So it's like, it wasn't, and I had to compete for it. And it was one of those things where, you know, I said, I want that job. And since I wasn't, you know, working directly for a super high-ranking person, the chances of me getting that position was very slim. And it turns out that after I applied, I called them up about a month and a half later, and I said, hey, did you guys ever decide who you were going to pick? And I said, let's find out what's going on here. So then they called the Pentagon, and the next day I get a phone call, you know, this Lieutenant Colonel from the Pentagon says, can you be here tomorrow? I'm like, this is for an interview. And I'm like, okay, you know, I don't live in Virginia. Yeah. This is back in the old ways of doing business. So I had to go make my own airline reservations while somebody was cutting orders and stuff like that. Anyway, flew in and had a great interview. And evidently I did well enough that I got the position. And that's where all of a sudden, here I am working at, I mean, literally a month later, I moved over there, and Tracy catches up to me in the summertime. And we are doing this job that requires a lot of crazy hours, but I'm hanging out with, you know, all kinds of famous people, Shali Khashvili, General Shali Khashvili. I'm hanging out with the President of the United States, the Vice President, the First Lady.
Which President was it?
President Clinton.
President Clinton, okay.
Yeah, I did 39 events with the Clintons. And yeah.
Wow.
And it was kind of like, you know, I didn't even know that was part of the job, you know, when they were advertising that job. And it was great. And you know, I got a chance to meet Bob Hope. What an honor that was to meet.
Yeah, sure.
He was 90 years old at the time, and we were in Hawaii. And he was, I think it was 1995, I think it was. And it was the one of the anniversaries, of the end of World War II. And so we had a bunch of anniversary events all over the place. And so we were at Hickam Field, you know, that got attacked during the Pearl Harbor attack. I got a chance to meet him and his wife Dolores and his daughter and his son-in-law. And just a great guy. And, you know, he was getting a little older, and so he was, his ability to, you know, just have a regular conversation was a little bit challenging and whatnot. But the minute Dolores walked him out on stage,
Turned it on, put
the microphone in his hand, he lit up and the audience was laughing like crazy. Everything he was talking about. And the minute she took the microphone away from his hand, he felt a little bit lost, and she sang an I Love You song to him. And that was like, man, what a great moment that was.
Oh,
just to be able to see him, you know, be one of his shows.
Yeah, some of the younger people probably don't remember Bob Hope, but us, we do.
Yes, we do. Well, and we got to meet later on in life, and we'll get to that one, but Gary Sinise. So after I got out of the military, but as we moved along and, you know, working at the White House and changed career fields.
How many times did you go into the White House?
Actually, into the White House?
I
would say probably about, I don't know, seven times. The rest of the events were either at the old executive office building, or at an event downtown, or at an event at a military installation when the president was there. Even the president was in Hickam when I was there. He just didn't make the show.
Mm-hmm.
He had other things to do. But it's just kind of interesting how that happens.
So then what?
Okay. You know, it's one thing when you have a career that you decide as a civilian, you pick your career, what you want to do, and that's that, right? Well, now somebody else is picking how you keep changing careers. So I went from being an air traffic controller to being a protocol officer and an aide-de-camp. And now they said, you know what? You be a program manager. So I went to go be a program manager in the B-1 bomber in Ohio. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, not Columbus, Ohio. Anyway, but before I get there, I wanted to say, when I was at the Pentagon, we had our third great child, okay? Caitlin, so I didn't forget it.
Let me take a break there on that third great child for a second, and we're going to go pay some bills, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Some people would call him a loser. He ran for state office. He was beaten. He started a business. He failed. He ran for Congress. He lost. He was nominated for vice president. He lost again. But he knew only those who never tried are the real losers. And Abraham Lincoln was no loser. Persistence. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
Commitment to victory.
He might have a pick six. He does.
Commitment to each other.
Touchdown! Touchdown, Illinois!
Commitment to the orange and blue. That makes us family. Join us Saturday as the Fighting Illini welcome Indiana to Memorial Stadium. Our coverage begins at 10 a.m. on your home for Fighting Illini football.
Fighting Illini football right here on Real Country, WJBM.
So we're back at the studio here with Alan and Tracy Lake. So continue on. Tell me what's going on.
So I get to be an expert in many trades. And now I'm magically a program manager working on the B-1 bomber, trying to get that thing to we're testing what was called moving map back then, which is basically GPS. So before you had GPS in your car, we were putting it in the B-1 bomber. Yes.
Right. What year was that?
We got there in 2000. We got there in 1998. We were there in 2001. Yeah.
Tracy's shaking her head. Yeah. Now you got it.
Yeah, we were there. And, you know, so now I'm trying to, increase the reliability rate of the aircraft while also adding GPS to some of the jets to get them to start using this capability that at that time nobody was really sure how to use it, you know, in a combat situation and whatnot. So really starting out putting it on this bomber. Everything was going great, and the Air Force says, great, now we're going to send you over to become an expert in technical training and education. So I go to headquarters, Air Education Training Command at Randolph Air Force Base. I pin on Lieutenant Colonel, and then from there they farm me out to be a squadron commander. About a year later, be a squadron commander in Montgomery, Alabama, at Maxwell Air Force Base at the Air and Space Basic Course. First time doing that, being a commander, I stood up a brand new squadron, and a year and a half later, I'm farmed out again, this time to go stand up something called 18th Air Force at Scott Air Force Base. And what they did was they took a numbered Air Force from each coast, and they put them together and made one big super numbered Air Force. So all the airlift in the world is managed out of Scott Air Force Base. All the military programmed airlift that's required to support our missions and whatnot.
Then and now?
Then and now, yeah.
Then and now.
Yeah, so they, so all that airlift happens over there, and the Tanker Airlift Control Center is aligned underneath 18th Air Force, and they're the actual command and control mechanism to make sure everything's okay. The real-time managing of what's happening to our jets around the world and the supplies that have to go where and if they're ready to be picked up, delivered, so on and so forth. So that's that was a great assignment for me. It was a lot of hard work. A lot of hours.
I can imagine.
Yeah, a lot of sometimes coming back at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my!
And as and so, it was what it was. And so I did great. And I, like I said, I did great in my eyes, and my report said I did great. And now I graduated, and it's time for me to go do something else. And so they said, why don't you go learn how to run Air Force bases? So they sent me to Tyndall Air Force Base, where we have F-15s and F-22s over there. And I am the Mission Support Group Commander Deputy. And while I'm there, they send me to a combat assignment in Baghdad.
In Baghdad.
In Baghdad. And
this year was, the year was?
So that was 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm what they call, in the Army calls it the mayor. The second guy in charge is always the guy that runs everything for the guy in charge. And so I was the mayor of our forward operating base. We had an airhead where we can, you know, capture a bunch of cargo planes coming through, dropping people off and picking people up and whatnot. And, you know, it was sporty times, you know. We have rules in place where we're not allowed to fire anything that we can't see where the firing is coming from. And we can't fire at mosques and whatnot and if fire is coming from there. But we're having a lot of, we're taking a lot of fire from what they call indirect fire. Somebody's basically trying to guess where we are. And trying to see if their weapons and their bullets and whatnot can reach our camp and see if they get lucky and whatnot. And so we had like 49 attacks happen. So by every third day we have an attack like that happen. Well, on one of my days as it was going by the way, the rule of operating at a forward operating base is you can't have a weapon with you at work. You have to have it locked away. But when you go to eat your meals, you get, or when you go to the gym, you got to take your weapon with you.
On base?
Yeah, yeah. Because you never know who's going to be coming around the corner and whatnot, you know, that kind of thing. And they had a problem one time where somebody who was a contractor was working in the dining facility and was trying to take out some folks. And so they figured the best way to deter that is have everybody
carry.
And so they know that, you know, they can return fire if required and whatnot. So, but during your day job, you just got it locked away. So I'm over on the ramp and I find out that, hey, the president of Iraq, Talibani, and the former prime minister, and I'll forget his name for now, but they came and they were flying in on the helicopters from the Green Zone. And so this was the first chance that the Iraqi Air Force was gonna fly in their Iraqi Air Force One, a C-130, they were gonna fly without US military in the cockpit observing. And so, you know, they're on their own. They can fly the airplane, but now we're just teaching them to fly to a certain level of fidelity where they can fly well and fly, you know, VIPs the right way, and so on and so forth. And so, anyway, so I get there and I'm standing in front of the aircraft. because always there's always a senior leader that should be there to salute, depart an Air Force One from whatever country, you know, coming in and out and whatnot, or even our visiting Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State, who I had a chance to both meet when they both came to visit one time. But as we were there, the plane would not start, and another lieutenant colonel from who was traveling with him, who was in the Army, but he was not part of the Air Force One. He's part of just traveling with the team with the Iraqi president. He runs out to me, and I had seen him a couple different times, so we knew each other. And he says, Alan. I said, "What's going on? The engine won't start." "Yeah, I can see that. There's a ladder in front of it." He goes, "No, you don't understand. They think it's an assassination attempt."
Oh boy.
And I go, "What?" He says, "Get your car." And so I'm looking over here, and there are 20 Iraqi officers and about 14 Iraqi Air Force cars, vehicles to use, but they don't want to use those. They want Alan Lake's red Chevy Blazer, and so a Trailblazer. So I run over, get that car, put him in there. Another car shows up, and I've got the president, the prime minister, some sort of other dignitary, two guys with Uzis in the very back, and the kids' seats in the section in the very back. Second car filled up with all kinds of people with Uzis, and we're zigzagging around the airport trying to get away. Now, mind you, I think it was Ike Skelton.
And you got to do the driving.
And I got to do the driving. Ike Skelton, about 8 months prior to that, was in a car accident, do the exact same thing in Baghdad Airport.
Ooh,
so he got hurt. He was a Missouri congressman at the time, and who I had met at the White House before. But so that was, you know, on my mind too. So I'm zigzagging around. We go to the Iraqi wing commander's office. So we hang out there. So I have, no kidding, a cell phone that I can use. And I am calling my forward operating base, which is, you know, the next base over and whatnot, through a New York connection to get a hold of my command and control element there and tell my boss, "Hey, there appears to be an assassination attempt going on over here. We're at the wing commander's office. We need an alternate airlift immediately. So that gets to to Cutter, that's running the air operations, the flag officer over there and whatnot, that we got a problem going on with a possible assassination attempt, and it involves one of the American assets as well. So after 45 minutes, the wing commander's office, they said, "Nope. We don't want to stay here. If this is an assassination attempt, they know that we would come here. We don't want them to come here. We want to go to your office, Alan." My office? I'm telling you, my office doesn't get cleaning, okay? It's a lot of dust. We have, it's horrible. So my office was at a place called the Glass House. So I get everybody back in the car and doing some more zigzagging around and whatnot. And we get to my office, the Glass House, and get him out of the car. And he has the biggest smile on his face because now he's at an U.S. military site, not one of his own sites. And I guess there was a little history. I guess when Saddam Hussein was in power, of all the services, the Iraqi Air Force was the one who was trying to take him out the most.
Okay.
But I think they were trying to do it with weapons and not this breaking of an aircraft or something like that. But he, this new president, he knew about that story, but didn't know what the loyalties were, you know, and whatnot. And they were all good people because we actually knew them and whatnot, but he's just a little bit scared. So
sounds like a movie.
It does sound like a movie. He has smiled. And then I went over and got him some Starbucks coffee that I'd been brewing. Tracy had set up with the commissary at Scott Air Force Base, and they would ship Starbucks beans. So Tracy sent me a bean smasher, if you will, is what I call it, so I can make coffee every day. Heck, we even had a guy named General Casey would come over. He's the guy, the four-star in charge of the operation. And he'd come over to drink coffee and whatnot, do some stuff over there. But, I've never seen somebody so happy to be in a dirty, dirty office building. I'll just leave it at that. Okay. So that was like, well, that happened today. You know, it's just weird stuff. And anyway, that assignment was over. Got back to Tyndall Air Force Base, and my boss got deployed, so I had to run the base. And then after that, I got an assignment to Randolph Air Force Base to be the base commander. The mission support group commander is the base commander, but also with the joint base operations that we have around the world, the senior leader, operational leader, becomes the base commander. In that case, we became Joint Base San Antonio, so I was there. But my wing commander was Colonel Jackie Van Ovost. Jackie Van Ovost is now General Van Ovost at Transcom at Scott Air Force Base.
I see.
So if you're listening and you know a little bit about the Air Force and Scott Air Force Base, and you see Jackie Van Ovost, you tell them that Alan Lake mentioned her on the radio.
All right.
Anyway, all is good, and ended up retiring at my 25-year point. I had always wanted to be, or thought I was going to be, you know, military first and civil service, because that's the family business. That's what we all do. My dad did it. My brother did it. And I was almost going to do it, but I would always wanted to know what my value was on the outside, and I accidentally found it. So on the day of my retirement ceremony, a company named Amgen Corporation, they make drug products for people who have cancer and stuff like that, and bone density drugs, white cell, red blood cell producers and whatnot. And they asked me, they said, hey, do you know anything about business continuity? And I said, yeah, sure. Because we call it in the Air Force continuity of operations.
And so, business continuity is?
So business continuity is preparing and planning for natural and man-made disasters. And you prepare for that by looking at risk and all the things that you have. So all the bad things that can happen to a company, and then all the critical, all the processes that the company does, and which ones are critical and require some redundancy and some planning, so it becomes resilient.
Yes. So we you got a game plan.
You got a game plan.
If anything happens, this is the game plan.
Right. So we come with a game plan. We train the people how we operate during times of crisis and whatnot. Also, we do exercises afterwards to make sure we can practice.
Okay.
And we did that in the military all the time. And so everybody's unofficial secondary specialty is readiness. You don't get a sticker that says, oh, your secondary is readiness. You don't get that. It's just automatically given. You go through exercises, you read plans, you do everything. You carry, look at risk all the time. And that's actually your career field on the outside.
I see.
So I got picked up with this company just north of Malibu, and did that for 6.5 years. I thought it was great. I was trying to get other people into it. And I went into semi-retirement in 2018, and that's when I moved back to Illinois. And an entity called Disaster Recovery Institute International, or DRI for short, the CEO at the time said, hey, Alan, why don't you be one of our instructors? Okay, so, and not only that, why don't you come up with a way of helping veterans out? So we created this program where we hand out scholarships to anybody who's currently on active duty, about ready to get out, or recently separated within 5 years, and that's not currently in the business continuity / resiliency career field. And we give them a free scholarship for training and the cost of certification and mentoring and help them find jobs. And it's all run by volunteers.
Well, that's great. And so you're on the ground floor on that.
Yeah, ground floor on that. So I spend a lot of my time talking to veterans all around the world and trying to get them to see if this is something they would think about, because most of them have never even heard that this was a career field. And so I just got back from teaching a course at the Cyber Command in Augusta, Georgia. They changed from Fort Gordon now they're called Fort Eisenhower. And before that, we taught at Edwards Air Force Base, a test pilot school there. And we've been all around the United States. And what was unique about this is we were at a party once in LA, and we talked to Patricia Heaton. She's on Everybody Loves Raymond. She's, you know, the wife, and she's on many other shows as well. And so she agreed to be our spokesperson to get a little video out there to make us look a little bit more legitimate, so it doesn't come across as if we're trying to sell something, right? If I tell you, why don't you take advantage of the scholarship, you're probably going to go, what are you trying to sell me?
Right.
And so we did that, and she said, Alan, can you please go talk to my best friend, Gary Sinise, about what you're doing? So now I get to meet the new Bob Hope, right?
Yes.
I met the old Bob Hope. Now I get to meet the new Bob Hope, because Gary Sinise spends all of his time helping veterans, and especially wounded warriors and whatnot. So we fly out to San Antonio, and we tell him what we're trying to get done here. And he's all excited, because he's aware about the plight of the military member. If you stay in too long, you know, then when you come out on the corporate side, everybody wants to treat you like you're 23 years old. You don't have any experience. You get to start at the bottom. with this career field, all your time in the military counts.
Yes.
And he even delayed his concert 15 minutes to talk to us because he thought this was great. And all he said was, can you do whatever you're doing? Can you also do it for Wounded Warriors? Absolutely. They're veterans also. They require special training because some of them have traumatic brain injury and some of them have PTSD. They can't focus and whatnot. But we try to work with them and whatnot. So the foundation that's part of DRI, the DRI Foundation. This year, they've crossed the 1,000 military member getting a scholarship. That means that they had found $3 million out there somewhere by anonymous donors to give to help somebody who they don't know, who are not going to advertise anything about the donor, and they're helping these people change lives and become something where you make a lot more than you made on active duty and your time counts and you don't have to go back and start at square one.
Well, that is a great thing.
Yeah.
It is a great thing. Boy, that's
so
fantastic.
We love doing that. And, you know, we have a bunch of volunteers. We've got volunteers in Austin. We got volunteers in Augusta. We got volunteers in Tampa and in Miami area, in Wisconsin, all donating their time to help veterans, mentor them, whatnot. You know, it's one thing to get a certification, but now, and you know how to walk the walk and talk the talk, but put that on paper in the form of a resume. Because, you know, a lot of these folks were like pilots, and like, I want to say I was a pilot. No. It's nice to say you're a pilot, but how many times did you do all these professional practices every day, every month? That's what we're going to talk about. That assignment was about those professional practices and what you did. So your day job was one thing, but getting ready for bad things to happen was always there. And these guys were just, we get these success stories and we have them call back in. So the former students, they call back in and tell them how they did it. So the folks can not just hear about it from me, but the people who got successful on the outside.
Now, if a veteran's listening or a relation to a veteran, somebody knows a veteran, and they want to get turned on to this program, who do they call? How do they contact?
Okay, so I know this sounds kind of non-standard, but you just reach out to me at allantlake@gmail.com. And Alan is A-L-A-N, and Lake is like pond.
That's right. Well, that's easy enough.
But, yeah, and you can say, I heard you on the radio.
That's right.
And just start out with that, and I'll know who you are, and I'll reach back to Chris over here and tell him how lucky we've been so far.
Fantastic. I love it. I love it. Man, how old are you?
59.
What a life you've lived and continue to live at age 59. That is fantastic. Love it. And Tracy, I'm not going to ask you. I know you're 10, 15, 20 years younger than Alan.
Absolutely.
But you've been there right along with him the whole time. And,
yep. And, we went on active duty 9 days after we got married.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. We got engaged after 3 months of dating.
Oh.
Actually, 38 years ago today we met.
Oh, 38
years ago. Hey, 38 years ago you met.
We met 38 years ago today.
Brenda and I will celebrate 36 years anniversary tomorrow.
Oh.
Actually, it'll be the 7th of November.
Okay.
So that's tomorrow. This is pre-recorded.
Oh, got it.
Well, thanks so much for coming today and driving from Chicago. Come down here and be with us here at the station. Really appreciate it. And I know the listeners out there really appreciate it, too, for all the veterans. So,
well, I thank you all for creating an environment that makes us want to serve, for those of us that are inclined to serve, and to respect the fact that we did that. And when we come back, nobody's shutting doors on us, like might have been so in the early 70s, late 60s and whatnot.
Things have changed.
Yeah.
And to the better, for sure. Well, thanks again.
Appreciate
it.